Call the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. First, we'll take the roll. I believe a quorum is present. And the first order of business would be the approval of minutes from the Monday, March 3rd meeting. Representative Slocum, are you prepared to make that motion?
So moved.
Thank you. Representative Slocum moves approval of the minutes from March 3rd. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Representative Kunin. Representative Kuhn, the chair, will move that House File 3585 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And also, I would like to have the AO8-1213 amendment adopted to the bill also at this time.
Thank you, Representative Kunin. The chair will move adoption of the 08-1213 delete all amendment. Any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? That amendment is adopted. And Representative Kuhn, I see that you have an amendment to that amendment as well, A3.
Yes, and I understand.
Would you like to?
This is something that we need to do also. I just found out about it, but I understand it's all okay, and that would be the 835.
I believe this is in the nature of a technical amendment.
Right, exactly.
Members, we'll just, the chair will move the adoption of the 3537A3 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? That amendment is adopted. Representative Kunin, to your bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is something that the counties, the Metropolitan Council, utilities, especially the Co-ops and Excel, have been working on since June, and everybody's in agreement with the bill as it's amended. I asked the committee if there's changes that you would like to see made to the bill, that we do it between this committee and the local government committee, as we have to get all parties into agreement on it. So if the committee would indulge us, that we would appreciate it. It took a while to get the agreement together, and we want to keep peace in the valley, let's say. So we'd appreciate that. I have three people here that would like to explain the whole the bill and how they arrived where we're at and what the bill actually does. And so, Mr. Chairman and committee members, they'll introduce themselves as they give their testimony.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Hackford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know we were moving along to get the bill in the shape that the author wanted, but I don't think any of us had that A3 amendment, that final technical amendment. We're not exactly sure what's taking place there.
I'm sorry, Representative Hackbarth. I thought that it had been distributed.
Long, no.
And
not it. That's for a different
bill. Mr. Eloff points out that the amendment has drafted has the wrong bill number on it anyway. So, given that, the chair will move to reconsider the A3 amendment.
Okay.
Any
Mr. Chairman,
discussion to that motion?
If it's going to cause a lot of confusion, we can fix it by the local government committee.
No, I don't think there's any problem, Representative Kern, just to moment or two delay. Those in favor of reconsideration of the A3 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The A3 amendment is before us. Has that been distributed, Mr. Pomeroy?
Yes.
Representative Hackbarth, do you have that at this point before you?
Yep.
I do need to change the number on the amendment. The reference should be to House File 3585, not 3537. So the chair will incorporate that change into the amendment. Is there any discussion then through the amendment? Representative Wester.
I'm going to look, but I didn't see this amendment before I came down here. I'm not sure I have access to it yet. So.
Representative Wester, it's basically a one-sentence amendment that reads, Subdivision 1 definition, project means a facility that generates electricity from renewable energy as defined in Section 216B, 2422, Subdivision 1, Paragraph C. It's, I believe, essentially a technical amendment. Representative Weston.
Representative Coonan, can you just restate what that, what the purpose of it is? And I assume that, is that a, the seabed qualified owner statute, or what statute is that?
Representative Westrum, I think Mr. Eloff would probably be the person to ask to respond to that. Mr. Eloff, can you enlighten us as to the nature of this amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 216B.2422 actually refers, I think, to the resource planning statute. It just happens to have a definition of renewable energy that fit in with what this project is looking to do. So the reason that we had an amendment and deleted the original Subdivision 1 was that it stated in there originally that all terms not defined in this particular section were to be defined as they were in 216B.2422. And that also contained a division of the word utility, and it restricted a utility to one that had more than 10,000 customers. And in speaking with the proponents of the bill, they didn't want to restrict the bill that is before you now to larger utilities, so we removed that reference entirely.
Representative Western, do you have further questions?
Go ahead, Mr. Chair.
Is there any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the H3585A3 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed. The amendment is adopted, and back to business, Representative Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I think if it's okay with you and the committee, we'll go ahead with that.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much.
Oops, sorry, Mr. Chairman. Okay. I think he's just trying to attract the attention of the stage.
All right, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'm Peter McLaughlin. I'm from a member of the Hennepin County Board and chair of the Metro Wind Energy Work Group of the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition. I'm representing Hennepin County on that group. The members of the Metropolitan Energy Policy Coalition and the Rural Minnesota Energy Board have been working on issues of renewable energy for several years. We wanted to craft a wind energy project to spur locally owned wind energy in greater Minnesota and to produce clean energy that could be consumed in the load-bearing metropolitan area. We believe it's in everyone's interest to produce homegrown wind electricity where the wind blows here in Minnesota, and it's in the interest of the Metro members to consume renewable energy that is no more costly than other electricity. So we think there's a great coming together of greater Minnesota and the metropolitan area. I'm joined today by Brian Kletcher and Tom Wormka, who represent the Rural Board, and they'll describe that. Our membership includes Anoka, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, Sherburne, and Washington counties, as well as the Metropolitan Council, which has a huge electricity load, joins with these counties in this effort. Our two groups have spent a year discussing with experts in the field how we can collectively contribute to wind energy development in a way that satisfies both rural and metropolitan interests. We think we've come up with that in this bill. We've had the support of the LPCMR recently and the Department of Commerce in this effort, this joint effort. Mr. Chairman, the bill has three basic components to it, if I might. First, it would allow counties to participate in seabed projects, which have been authorized in the past. There was a need to clarify the fact that we could actually participate in those seabed projects. Secondly, this would allow for renewable energy projects, an extension of the Winona model that this committee has passed on in the previous year, so we could use that model to participate. And three, it allows for the use of some these projects to be financed through the use of tax-exempt bonds. It's a very simple bill with a lot of support, and I turn it over to my rural colleagues with whom we've been working very, very closely over the last several years to develop this project. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Commissioner McLaughlin.
Mr. Chair, my name is Tom Warren. I'm a county commissioner from the great county of Fertile County, Minnesota, and we're involved in the Rural Energy Board, along with other 16 other counties, there are 17 total, in the south, in the southwestern part of the state. Our objective in working with the Metro, working for clean renewable energy for the Metro area and for the rural area, is our vested interest in this project with the rural economic development, plus sharing that along with other benefits of the project with our citizens in southern Minnesota and southwest Minnesota. This is a seabed project. Some of it could be seabed, some of it isn't seabed, but they both try to reach the same objective, and that is to produce electricity that's environmentally friendly when the wind does blow. And lately it's been blowing a lot in southern Minnesota and southwest Minnesota because the roads are continually needing to be scraped off with snow, and it's hurting our budget. So we do have the wind source, it's clean, it's available, and working together with, like Mr. McLaughlin, Commissioner McLaughlin said, it's been a pleasure to work with the Metro. I think it goes both ways. We've learned a lot from those people, and they've learned a lot from us. And we've toured each other's facilities. They've been out and toured, did a tour of the wind farms that are already built and in operation. We've been up and looked at the facilities in the Metro area that are big consumers of electricity, and they would like to get some of our wind electricity. So I say it's a win-win for everyone.
Thank you, Commissioner Warmson.
Mr. Chair, I'm Brian Kletcher, Red Oak County Commissioner and Chairman of the Rural Minnesota Energy Board. Again, like Tom said, we represent 17 different counties in southwest, south central Minnesota. A great organization, and we're proud to be working with the Metro Counties and the Met Council on this legislation. The long-term impact of this will spur greater opportunity for local investment of small wind projects throughout rural Minnesota and help the Metro area jurisdictions begin to reduce the rate of escalation in the long-term cost of electricity. Like Commissioner McLaughlin stated, that the utilities are on board. We've met with them. They're supportive of this, and we continue to move forward with that. Who benefits? Actually, everybody benefits from this. Long-term renewable energy is vital for the state of Minnesota, and it goes much beyond that. This legislation will help us as counties succeed in this growth of renewable energy, and we look for your support on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for any of the testifiers? Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank the testifiers, Representative Coonan. I know Commissioner McLaughlin, you've been working on this a long time, and I know you've put a lot of work into it.
working with our folks out in the poor country down there in the southwest area. One question I've got, a lot of wind. I don't believe this bill would allow cities to go between cities. And is that something that we ought to do, or something we can do later on? And I'm not suggesting we toss that in your bill, because I think it's a good piece of legislation. I want to sign on, Lyle, and co-author with you. But.
Well, Mr. Chair, may I answer that, or try to, attempt to?
Commissioner Warnke.
The bill doesn't address cities per se, because they already have this authority. For some reason, counties were omitted. That's what's been the big stumbling block for the metro and the rural to move this forward. We need to get this legislation so we can move forward. If the city has always had the authority to generate electricity for their city, where the rural people, I'm talking only rural, relied on REA.
Yeah.
So counties did not have a play, didn't have a card to play in the first time of the hand was dealt, but now we're trying to get that so that we can have the same authority as cities do.
Thanks. That's good. Thank you.
Representative Westrom?
Mr. Chair, just to point out to the members, one of the the first commissioner testifying talked about clean wind that does exist out in western Minnesota, and even with the dirty coal plants in the Dakotas, our wind still is pretty clean out there. So just wanted to make that observation for Representative Wagenius and others that sometimes might think differently.
And the more we can get the farmers in the western part of the state to practice no-till agriculture, the cleaner it will be, Representative Weston. Representative Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. To any of you, I'm just wondering, you know, the partnership, you know, heard about it for many years, obviously, but you know, just the size, I mean, how much of this, how much power are you planning to produce when you're at some sort of equilibrium or agreed upon level between the metro need? And I'm wondering, you know, you got a lot of counties in the plan. Are you looking at projects that are already somewhat mature and somewhat developed, and can you move quickly, or do you have to put new projects into the MISO queue and kind of on line, and how far along is this?
Is there a question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterson, it is our intent to have new projects come on board with this, and size, you know, we're going to look at anywhere from the 2 megawatts to 100 megawatts, whatever is workable. Our priority is to generate electricity from the wind. It's a great renewable resource, and it's our priority to do that.
So you're going to be looking at new projects that haven't started the development stage yet. So that
Commissioner McLaughlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Peterson. We're going to be looking at new projects, but there also have been some seabed projects that have been discussed, and we're going to try to potentially piggyback on some of those that haven't been brought to completion yet. So that's the other direction we're going.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I think that's a good preferred method, because between now and local government, if you're going to get a new one, then you should probably put your money into the MISO queue before you get to local government. The waiting list is very long.
I think they probably expect to be around in 612 years. So, right. Representative Peters. Representative Gosser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to ask Commissioner Warmka if Faribault County is going to be interested in funding some of these seabed projects or partnering with these various groups that are going to try to build some of them, because I think there's a funding mechanism that's lost somewhat in seabed projects. They're very expensive, and you have a relatively low bonding rate and so forth that could be of some great assistance.
Commissioner Warnke.
Representative Hilke, to answer my good friend Mr. Gunther's question, I think I smell a trap someplace.
No,
but I cannot speak.
I
know where you're coming from, and your county is our next door neighbor, as small as it is, they're still our next door neighbor. They are number one in hogs and possibly in our area number one in wind now too. And if the opportunity would present itself, and the opportunity was right for our small county to get involved in it, I'm pretty sure that we would. If you're talking about an investment, I'm pretty sure that we would. But I can't speak for the whole board. That's why I was thinking he was going to try to spring a trap on me. Because he and I go back and forth. We have some history. We go back and forth on a lot of things. But to be fair with you, Mr. Gunther, that in my mind and in my judgment, I think if the conditions were right and the situation was right, we would absolutely be in.
I assure you that I wasn't setting a trap for you. And as you said, we might have some differences, but we always end those differences with friendship.
Oh,
that's very true.
That's paraphrasing what he said.
Well, we do, and we always said that as friends.
Are there further questions for the witness?
You're not a cool money.
You're a crap again, aren't you?
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, the chair will renew his motion that House File 3585, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Coon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee.
Representative Kalin, House File 3717.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3717 to get it before the committee. I don't know if you want the full motion yet or if you want to wait.
There's all in due time, Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, House File 3717 is a bill aimed to help to streamline the process of working with local governments when transmission lines are being proposed, and help to aiming to avoid contested cases and work with more, seek more collaboration between local units of government and utilities. Some of you may know that I cut my teeth politically on the Chisago project, 230,000 volt power line proposed through Chisago County in the late 90s by then NSC. After pointing out that the line was really a bulk power transfer line, and that the local need to be resolved through another issue, through another approach, Xcel is now in the process of seeking approval, and actually has gotten a certificate of need from the Public Utilities Commission and a general route permit for the line that I believe we suggested was the best local option. The Public Utilities Commission has actually deferred judgment for 90 days on the specific permit route through downtown Lindstrom. The issue that this bill seeks to address is the issue of encouraging more notice for local units of government when these lines are initially being proposed and being considered by the utility, and also to encourage more collaboration and more input in an informal way, rather than what ends up happening is you have local units of government, local cities that that feel like they have to get up to speed very quickly on electrical issues, that the tables are tilted against them, the timeline is tilted against them, and often feel like the only choice they have to protect their interest is to become an intervener and go through a contested case. We'd like to see that not happen, and actually I think that the process that's happening now with the 90-day negotiation, I'll say, and I'd say that the negotiations are going well, and I appreciate Xcel and the City of Lindstrom working together to find a solution that works for everyone. This bill has three pieces to it. First, there's a notice of an intent to file 180 days before actually filing an application. That's paragraph A to every local unit of government that has jurisdiction along a potential routing path. Two, if any local unit of government wants the utility to appear at a public meeting to discuss more formally the project, they can do so, and the utility needs to show up within 30 days at a public meeting. However, the utility obviously could be forced to meet with 30 local jurisdictions within a single county, and we think that's unreasonable, and so I'm proposing that a single unit, or a single meeting of all affected local units of government, as long as it's a public meeting, could satisfy that requirement. And we're actually adding some significant protections against a local action, a construction moratorium that a local unit of government might enact after receiving this notice of intent to file. Currently, by Public Utilities Commission rules, pretty much before they file their certificate of need application, they have to file a proposed plan for providing notice, but actually that 90 days doesn't apply to the actual notice. It's merely a plan. As soon as the plan is on file with the Public Utilities Commission for notice, it's a little vague in terms of what protection the utilities would have. This bill would actually strengthen that protection against local action, defensive action, significantly. So appreciate your time and consideration, members. And Mr. Chair, with me is Mayor Keith Carlson from the City of Lindstrom, and then and also John Olinger, the City Administrator, who also serves as the Zoning Officer for the City of Lindstrom.
Thank you for thank you for allowing us to testify. My experience was meeting with Xcel Energy. I was elected mayor.
Carlson, would you please identify yourself for the record?
Okay, thank you. I'm Keith Carlson, mayor of Lindstrom, Minnesota. My experience with Xcel Energy was I was elected mayor took office in January 2002. We met with Xcel Energy, had a few brief meetings, and the city did enlist the services of legal counsel. Basically, the matter was dropped, and I left office. I retired in January of 2005. The city council was again notified. I ran for office in 2006, and when I was elected, we were notified of the meetings with Xcel Energy taking place again. There were no members of the city council that were still from the previous city council in place. We had a new city administrator, and the timeline that we were given with Mr. Olinger and I was very brief. We seemed to have to respond immediately, like on a Thursday, to be ready to respond by the following Tuesday, if I'm not mistaken by the timeline. I don't have all the dates, Mr. Olinger does, but it just seems like as a city, which in our case we meet monthly, we meet once a month at a regular meeting, it just seemed too condensed for us to be able to really respond. But Mr. Olinger is here to go through some of the timeline and so on, and I'll turn it over to him. Thank you.
Mr. Olinger, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is John Olinger. I'm the city administrator for Lindstrom. We're just going to speak on our case, because that's all I'm familiar with. Being a small city, we don't have a lot of reserves on hand, and our legal budget's pretty limited, so time is something that is one of our assets. That's a great thing to us as a city. And I know we really want to do have streamlined processes in government, but time in government and our slow plotting really helps, especially to understand what's going on. We have diverse interests within the city. We have many different issues going on that we have to be able to understand, and then we have to be able to have time to understand what the consequences are of things. 3 months and a 3-month process to be able to look at what the implications are of putting 115 kilovolt line, upgrading it from what we have currently, just doesn't give us enough time to be able to respond to that. So it forced the city into a litigated process. and that's not where we want it to be. We're currently working with MnDOT. We've been working with them for 3 years on redoing Highway 8. We're working together with them very well. We never wanted to stop them. We didn't tell them to put it someplace else in somebody else's backyard. But we wanted to be able to shape it so that we could allow people beyond us to have the power that they need, not begrudge them, but we also wanted them to recognize that they created certain negative impacts in our community. And we want to be able to mitigate that. And we need time to be able to work with and Xcel, if they come in, or Highway 8 and MnDOT, the bigger utilities, just to be able to give us that asset, that resource, that is the most valuable thing for us as a city. So we'd appreciate it if you would support this bill to give cities and communities that are smaller a little bit more time to work with them to be able to provide meaningful input into the application process as a larger utility comes through our community. Thank you.
Thank you. A question for the witnesses, Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Olinger, am I given to understand that your protest was over a line that was already in existence that was being upgraded? Is that what I thought I heard you say?
Yeah, it's a current line going through our town. I think it's 69 kilovolts. It's being increased to 115. But the current line doesn't carry any current in it. The switch is shut off because I believe the power from Wisconsin is too high and it would burn up the line. And so this is... They're trying to increase the size of the line in order to match something on the other end. Right. With that, the towers would be increased, the pole size would be increased, and the width at the base would be increased in our small corridor. And that's been some of our objectives. We have to understand the implications of, in this small corridor, what does the impact of 90-foot towers now versus the current 70-foot towers with holes at the base that would be 4 feet wide in a very narrow corridor. What are the impacts of that?
Actually, he went ahead and answered what my next question was going to be. I wanted to ask him about the impact of a 69 kV line to 115. By the way, I think whether there's power currently in the line or not has little to do with the right. bill or with anything, actually. I have a hunch with the interconnection agreements and the necessity of having the grid be linked together six ways to Sunday, it has a very important impact. But perhaps when Mr. Alders gets here, we can have him describe what the physical infrastructure and the right-of-way needs are of upgrading a line from one size to the other. While I have the mic, though, if I may ask Representative Kalin a question. A couple years ago, we went through, as we were pushing the renewable energy thing, one of the things that was becoming apparent to many of us lay people was that the transmission infrastructure, and I'm not just talking about the big lines coming from Buffalo Ridge, but the stuff that runs around primarily the metro area, because we seem to be the target and the recipient of all this green energy that's coming. We needed to do a lot of upgrades here, and so we put the CapEx 2020 program into play. How does this monkey with that?
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, appreciate the opportunity to say something I forgot to in my opening comments, and that is that the CapEx 2020 process is in many ways a model for the informal open conversation that's happening now. I believe that a lot of the township officers through your community, Representative Blige and others along that southern edge of the metro and collar counties there, that kind of early input and early conversation helps to make the case for why the lines are needed. As you've mentioned, not only the RES, but also just general need and upgrading our infrastructure across the board. I think that was one of the pieces of the conversation that gets lost in when cities are largely on the defense, because then it becomes a sort of NIMBY, not in my backyard, you know, protecting my own assets. I mean, the administrative law judge in the Lindstrom case did identify the unique characteristics of the historic and scenic downtown that need to be protected, and I think that's one reason why the PUC wanted to defer judgment. And I think this goes to the model of CapEx 2020, and I think what we'll see more and more I believe the utilities are on their way to doing what's in 3717, but I think that we do need to make sure that the folks that are affected have greater knowledge and input, and we can avoid those contested cases so we can do the upgrades.
Further questions for these witnesses? Seeing none, Mr. Alders? Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'm Jim Alders from Xcel Energy. I'm Director of Regulatory Administration. I'm the guy involved in Certificate of Need Matters in front of the Public Utility Commission, and indeed have been with the Chisago Transmission Line project its entire life. Mr. Chairman, members, there is some confusion surrounding the process of obtaining permits for transmission lines in the bill. In the way of background, there are two permits necessary for transmission lines from the Public Utility Commission. One is a certificate of need, and the need process doesn't look at where the line should go. The need process looks at, is indeed there a need for the facility? Do we need to maintain the reliability of the transmission system? And have we picked the right configuration, the right voltage? There's a second separate process. A route permit also has to be obtained from the Public Utility Commission. And indeed, the issues you heard about from the city of Lindstrom and some of the public participation process you've heard about are related to the routing process. Where should the line go? What sort of structures should be selected for the line? Are there any conditions necessary to protect the environment when you build and operate that line? Okay, so you need a need certificate first and then a route certificate. The bill before you attempts to amend the certificate of need process. In the Public Utility Commission rules, there already is a process for determining what appropriate and meaningful notice should be for local units of government. The Commission's rules lay out a process where the utility has to file a plan for how they're going to provide notice. That plan is debated, and any party can provide comments on whether or not the utility got it right. The Commission approves or modifies the plan, and then the utility sends out notice of its intent to file an application for a certificate of need. In developing those rules, the Commission dealt with the issue that's been presented to you today and debated whether or not notice should be some significant period of time before we file an application, or whether it should be closer to when that application is actually filed, so that when a local unit of government gets that notice, they can go look at something. And indeed, the judgment of the Commission has been we ought to keep the notice closer to the point in time when an application is filed. Once we file an application for a certificate of need, there is a year-long public process that takes place. And it's not necessarily a contested case proceeding. And during that year-long certificate of need process, the location of the facility is not debated. What I hear from the city of Lindstrom has more to do with that route permitting process, I believe. In the route permitting process, we don't go through the plan for notice. Rather, your statute provides that notice has to be sent to local units of government at the time of a route permit application. And again, the Commission has a process that can be anywhere from 6 to 12 months long where any local unit of government can make a proposal for something other than what the utility has proposed in terms of location or whether the line should be underground or overhead and what have you. And indeed, those issues can be worked through, and the process that has been designed around that is encourages public participation, including participation of local unit of government. Now, the Chisago case is out of the ordinary. For a number of reasons, it has taken on different lives over time. The permitting of the facility has spanned 10 years. The design of the facility has changed over time, and so it's not it's not typical of the way the process usually unfolds. The most recent certificate of need case in which we went through that notice plan process was the CapEx facilities that are currently being considered by the Public Utility Commission. We went through that notice plan process. We laid out a plan. It was approved by the commission. And approximately a month before we filed our certificate of need application, we sent notice out to nearly 500 local units of government and nearly 73,000 landowners and local residents. And we published ads in just over 100 newspapers, both dailies, weeklies, and shoppers. There is ample opportunity for notice, if notice is the issue, within the existing process. Now, we take on our own initiative efforts to interact with local units of government as we develop route permit applications. Not so much certificate of need applications, but rather route applications. Quite candidly, feedback from most local units of government about whether the line is needed or not is it going through my community? If it is, I'll worry about that need. If it's not, you know, it's not high that they're high on their priority list. But the effort that the representative was talking about indeed is our effort to engage the community prior to filing a route application. We've already filed a certificate of need application for those CapEx lines. That need process is underway. We have not yet filed route applications. And so there is opportunity to work with folks that are interested in that routing question if they're interested in a little more time, a little bit more notice built into rule or law. We are concerned about 6 months notice from the standpoint that it lengthens the development cycle for transmission lines. If indeed the issue is a route issue and if indeed your judgment is different than the Public Utilities Commission, we'd be willing to try and work with the bill and see if we can come up with it.
Question for Mr. Alden.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beard.
I do. I was going to defer to Representative Magnus here, but Mr. Alden, so just to be clear, you're saying that once you have the certificate of need, you don't file for a route before you have your certificate of need in hand, do you? And once you do, you've got a minimum of 6 months that you need to work that process. Is that process a minimum of 6 months long to work on the route determination?
Mr. Alders.
Chair Representative Beard, there is kind of a cafeteria approach to how to time need and routing applications. It depends on the circumstances. You cannot file a route application until after you file a need application. Okay, but the utility does have the option of filing one shortly after the other,
okay,
so that the two processes can move concurrently, and in the circumstance where there isn't much debate about whether or not there's need, and in a circumstance where there isn't much debate about whether or not there are significant routing options. know, so for lower voltage, shorter lines, that tends to be the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. For a situation like the CapEx one, where the utilities are proposing on the order of 600 miles of higher voltage transmission, our judgment was it was better to start the certificate of need process because we didn't know exactly where the routes were going to be, and then follow up with some public participation to develop routes, and then file a route application.
Mm-hmm.
To get more directly to your question, even when the two processes overlap, there is on the order of 6 months before any public hearings take place on the issue, from the time notice is given, application is filed, and 4 or 5 months later, hearings take place.
Mm-hmm.
And then 4 or 5 months after that, the commission makes the ultimate decision. So even after we file applications, there's ample opportunity for interactions of the kind you heard about today.
The follow-up question that I wanted to ask, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alders, are you expert enough in electrical engineering to describe the difference between a 69 kV line and a 115 kV line?
Mr. Alders.
Or do we need to drag somebody else down here for that?
I can give you the regulatory guy's understanding after hanging around the engineers for a long time.
That would be sufficient.
69 kV transmission line typically utilizes wood poles, single wood poles for structures. There are three cable conductors at the top of that. Those poles on insulator strings. Those insulator strings typically are 4 insulators long. If you ever look at a transmission line, you can count the insulators at the top of the pole next to each conductor. Spans between structures are on the order of 150, 200 feet, depending on the circumstance. Structures are on the order of 60, 65 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
115 kV transmission line in a typically are about 10 or 15 feet taller than that. In the downtown Lindstrom case, it's a little bit taller because circumstances are tight. Length of the insulators is on the order of 7 or 8 instead of 4. We can match, if we go out and replace an existing line with a new line, we can match the spans of the existing line. In the case of Lindstrom, we propose replacing 12 structures with 7 through the area of downtown Lindstrom. In this case, we propose steel poles so that the diameter of the poles at the base can be reduced. But generally that's the case.
And one last question, Mr. Representative Kalin. You've talked about, Representative, about cutting your teeth on fighting a power line proposal. Is this the one that you cut your teeth on?
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Beard, I was going to mention that there was low-hanging fruit on that power line as well, but I think it's all been picked from last year's discussion.
You're treading on thin ground here, the metaphor police there.
Representative Beard, it was actually the initial Chisago project application, which was the 230,000 volt, rather than the 115, 161 that is an issue here, and actually I believe that that the general line was one of the ones that the initial interveners had suggested would meet the reliability issues and allow the line to be charged and provide proper resistance for interconnectivity and the issues that you referenced before.
Thank you.
Representative Magnus.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a bit confused about this bill. As I understand it, you're looking at a transmission line. Is that correct?
Well,
well,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm trying to figure out the statutes here because before the PUC had the authority to approve all of this, the EQB had the authority to approve all this. Mr. Alders and I know of, we spent years on this because I served a couple of terms on the EQB some years ago. So talked about this, but I'm wondering why we have this bill out of the in the statutes for the large energy facilities and not statutes 216B2425 with transmission lines. That's what I'm trying to figure out, number one in my mind.
Representative Galen?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Mr. Alders and I were conferring about the old days of the EQB, PUC conundrum as well. The question was...
Mr. Chairman, my question is why, since it's a transmission line, why aren't we looking at the statute that of 216B-2425 that covers the state transmission lines and the whole process that goes through this and outlines it since they change this over instead of going through the statutes to deal with the certificate of need for a large energy facility. That's where I'm a bit confused right now at.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Magnus. I think that we just had a detailed negotiation about 5 minutes ago, and I think to that point, partly it's because as we wrote the bill, as I suggested the bill, council thought because of certificate of need that it belonged in the certificate of need statute, which is the 216B243. I'm going to make an amendment here, Mr. Chair, that I think will then suggest a change rather than actually move an amendment, Representative Magnus, that may actually answer your question. I think that it may be more appropriate to be talking about make this notice of intent to file requirement for route permits rather than for certificate of need. And so on line 1.9, I'd replace certificate of need with route permit. And I don't know if Mr. Elis believes that then we would then change the location of where we would insert these provisions. I don't know if that answers your concern, Representative Magnus.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess what got me wondering about this is if we, we're changing the statutes here, we're adding a section in the statutes, and I'm trying to figure out just what effect that has on the whole system here, because it's been, as I said before, the EQB had oversight responsibility for pipelines and high voltage transmission lines, and that was quite a process, and I spent a lot of time working on that through the years that we were there. But now the PUC has it, and we need to face the fact we need to keep putting in transmission lines and everything else. What I'm trying to figure out is what effect is this going to have? I'm certainly sympathetic to the city of Lynchham. I think all of us would be. But I'm trying to figure out in my mind is the changes we're making here in the statute, what effect that's going to have on the state as we try to move ahead. Is this going to change the process of going through transmission routing and everything else? That's the question I've got. What effect that's going to have on
the state? Representative Taylor.
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Alders may wish to chime in first and if you have anything to offer.
Mr. Alders.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Magnus, the Environmental Quality Board had responsibility for route permitting. Public Utility Commission had responsibility for certificates of need. And a few cycles of the legislature ago, 2001 or thereabouts, I forget when, the routing process was transferred to the commission. Okay. And so I was trying to get at exactly what you're probing. I believe that indeed if the question is more related to routing, we can work with the author to adjust things. My real concern is that I don't think it's in the state's interest to extend the development cycle of all of these transmission lines unnecessarily. And to that extent, I think we can work
with the bill to avoid that. But as it currently stands, I think it misses the mark.
Representative Kalin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Magnus, I believe that because the having some intimacy with how the process works, both as a member of this committee and delving fairly deeply into some of the statutes, but then also having now twice been on the other end of the notice issues and having worked with the city to try to resolve some of the timing issues that I think because the certificate of need application does precede the route permit application, that perhaps reducing the timeline in line 1.10 would help satisfy some of the concerns, but also I would like to move, Mr. Chair, to delete on line 1.9, this would be an oral and verbal amendment, Mr. Chair, to delete certificate of need and replace it with route permit. And perhaps Mr. Ellis might also want to advise about relocating the where this falls within statute as well. But
Mr. Ellis, do you have advice for us?
Well, the reviser will ultimately put this where the reviser's office thinks it best belongs. My opinion is that 2425 refers to the state transmission plan, and I don't see it really belonging there. You're essentially piggybacking on an existing process there, which is described under the certificate of need process. So my advice would be to leave it in section 243.
Representative Kalin.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Alders is recommending that we look at Chapter 216E as the proper location, but we can, I've not yet been familiar with this instance where we, after making an amendment, we changed the exact location, so I don't know exactly how to handle this, but we can resolve this technical
issue. Representative Kalin, I think you would have the opportunity to deal with that technical detail before the bill gets to the local government committee.
Great.
So did you then wish to move the amendment on line 1.9 of striking the word certificate of need and inserting the words route permit?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that amendment.
Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed? Kalin, oral amendment is adopted. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Hiltian. Representative Kalin, I've been listening to the discussion, and usually, from my recollection, when I've been dealing with permitting issues, there's typically a 60 or a 90-day waiting period, and to go to 180 days I think is a little bit excessive, and especially after listening to the testifier talk about how many days are involved after you file for the initial certificate of need. But the one thing that I do agree with you on is, as the testifier alluded to, you could file that certificate of need, and then shortly thereafter you could actually go after the route permit process as well. And I think that Lindstrom does serve as a good case of making the case that you should have a little bit more time to consider this proposal. And so I would move that on line 1.10, we delete 180 days and insert 120 days.
Representative Kalin, your comment?
Mr. Chair, I think that's something I can live with. I think it's a reasonable accommodation, and I think it would help satisfy some of the concerns of the utility, and I think that I thank Representative Welty for bringing that forward. I can live with it.
Mr. Alders, do you care to comment?
Mr. Chairman, I think a 4-month notice before a route application is something we can provide.
Any discussion to the Welty amendment, Representative Beard?
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I have to be the one to ask this question.
We can provide it, of course. You can provide 4 years if we ask you to provide it, Mr. Alders. But people, what I want to ask is this entire bill necessary? I can solve the question of where to stick it in the statutes by just encouraging us to vote the bill down. Then we don't have to worry about where to put it in the statutes because, Mr. Chairman, it appears that for 100 years, the system's been working rather well. I'm sorry there seems to be an issue in Lindstrom. It sounds like things are working themselves out just fine. And we have a saying, at least we did when I was on City Council, bad cases make bad law. So if somebody's having an issue there, I'm not sure why we need to afflict the rest of the state with a solution that's looking for problems elsewhere, I guess. And I don't mean to be hard on Representative Kalin. I'm just reminding the members that we have a pretty high bar we need to cross here when we're monkeying with the infrastructure that makes it possible to live in Minnesota when it's 20 below zero and it's dark half the year. Folks, I don't see skullduggery being committed by the public utilities here and trying to pull a fast one on somebody. Their transmission lines or pipelines, they're big deals. You can't do them in the middle of the night. And I think the system has been working rather well. And the whole exercise, I think, has been fruitful to discuss, but I would encourage us not to pass the bill. And so, Mr. Alders, with all due respect, you parsed your words well. Yes, you could make four months work. You could also make 4 years work. But does it serve the public interest? Members, I think not.
Well, Representative Beard, I think that was a little more to the bill than to the amendment.
I would encourage us to vote down the 120-day amendment. I guess what I'll say.
Further discussion to the amendment. All those in favor of the Welty amendment to delete on line 10, 180, and insert 120, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. To the bill. Representative Beard, did you want to repeat your remarks?
You just rewind the tape from about 31:30 and play that last few moments.
Representative Osmond.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd just like to speak in favor of the bill. I know that there is as things get moving rather rapidly within our changes that we need to have in our infrastructure, there is the reality that small cities, just like townships, have a difficult time responding to this rapid movement, and I think we need to acknowledge that. And exactly what the specifics are, I think we're working on. I think it is appropriate to continue to move forward with this concept. I would suggest, Mr. Chair, though, we provide instructions for them to change the title of the bill because of the changes that we've made with the amendments also.
Thank you, Representative Osmondson. Good observation. Duly noted, I trust, Representative Kalin. Further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Kalin would renew his motion that House File 3717 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. All those in favor of that motion, please signify by saying aye.
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 Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is passed to local government. Members, I had intended initially to take up the second Kalin bill at this time, but as you're aware, this is an ambitious agenda today. We're going to have to recess at 4 o'clock to deal with the other obligations of members. Plan is to reconvene at 6. And I think with the testimony that we have lined up for the second Kalin bill that we will defer consideration of that until we reconvene. And at this time, I think we probably do have time to take up my bill, House File 3578. Hopefully we can dispatch that within the time that we have left. And so we will take up for consideration at this time House File 3578. Madam Chair, I would move House File 3578 for consideration. It would be my intention to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the energy omnibus bill.
Okay. Representative Chelsea moves that House File 3578 be recommended to pass and to the Committee on Finance. But we'll be laid off.
Madam Chair, I have with me Pam Marshall, who brought forward this proposal, and I would ask her at this time to get some of the background to the situation and to the proposed solution.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Marshall. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Pam Marshall. I'm the director of the Energy Sense Coalition. Our organization promotes more affordable energy service through regulatory and legislative advocacy and also through direct conservation and bill payment assistance programs. Last year, this statute was enacted to give some discretion but some guidance to the department to engage in a pre-purchase program for propane. The general idea is you take some of the Federal Energy Assistance Program money or LIHEAP funds and purchase propane in the summer months when the prices are lower rather than wait until winter prices take per gallon and people's grants go that much less further. I think we need the ability to pre-buy propane. I think we need it for several reasons. First of all, between 16% and 19% of the entire state's LIHEAP population heats with propane. There's about 109,000 households that have applied so far, so it's a substantial number of households that use propane for their primary heating fuel. Last season, the average propane grant covered about 52% of a winter heating bill. This year, very conservatively, we think it'll cover about 47%. And that is conservative because it assumes a conservative price per gallon, but also normal winter weather, and we know we haven't had that. Also, LIHEAP funding cuts mean either lower participation rates, lower grants, or a combination of the two. And so the ability to stretch those funds wherever we can, I think, is imperative. And I think we also need this program because propane prices have increased 78% since the average paid during the winters of 2000 to 2005. This bill would require the department to hold back some funds in order to purchase propane, one-third of the propane that's used in aggregate across the state in a pre-purchase program. Just to give you an example of the level of savings that are possible, in October of this year, the price per gallon was $1.77. It's now $2.18. So even if we purchased relatively late in the fall and October is getting late, we still could have saved about $440,000. More importantly than looking at 1 year's potential savings, though, is to look at the cumulative. Since about 1993, we could have saved about $5 million. We understand that it's difficult to hold back scarce resources when the needs are as immediate as they are, But we also understand that the department has carried over significant amounts of money from year to year, and we think it should be used for these purposes. Again, doing so can bolster the effectiveness of the Energy Assistance Program funds by ensuring that households can purchase more fuel with the same amount of grants. And we urge your support for this bill.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Are there any questions? Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Marshall, by holding back 5%, you did identify the downsides. If we have a very bad winter, there'll be some people that will suffer if we don't have the amounts, the full amounts to expend. However, I agree with buying, pre-purchasing it. Is there any way that we could, when does this money become available from the federal government, and when do we have to expend it?
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, typically what happens from one LIHEAP program year to the next is that the department does reserve some carryover funds. Right now, it's my understanding that the department has $6 million in just reserve and another $2 million in carryover that's used to open the program each fall. The funds have to be spent by September 30th each year, and while I agree that there is a trade-off here between an immediate need and a long-term need, the same thing is true every time LIHEAP funding goes up and down. We'll have $77 million one year, $110 million the next. It's exactly true that in the year when we have $77 million, that a lot of people are hurt because we can't meet that immediate need. I think the question is, if we're going to spend $12 million a year in aggregate on propane, do we take a third of that and spend it on a pre-purchase and lock in at a lower price or not? And I also think that if the department has that much money to carry forward from one year to the next, this is how it should be spent.
Madam Chairman, my question was basically this. When does the money become available from the Department of Commerce to purchase propane?
Madam Chair, Representative Gunther, in any, typically after October 1st is when Minnesota receives our federal LIHEAP allocation. It's also true that in many years we receive supplemental appropriations from the LIHEAP Contingency Fund. So those funds, if we choose to hold some back, are available anytime from that October through the next September for pre-buy, so we could be buying in June, July, throughout the summer and into the fall months prior to September 30th.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you. I see Assistant Commissioner Garvey is here. I don't know when the money becomes available. Does it become available July 1st, or is it after the purchase has to be done in September? Or when can we do this? Maybe you can shed some light on this, please.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Edward Garvey, Director of the Office of Energy Security, Representative Gunther. As Ms. Marshall said, at the beginning of the federal fiscal year, which is October 1, there's the possibility of a release of federal low-income heating energy assistance program funds. But given federal appropriation process, frequently those funds are not automatically available on October 1, but will be made available sort of weeks beyond that. She's also made clear that there are additional allocations or disbursements from the federal government under the LIHEAP program. So the question that I think you're driving towards, Representative Gunther, is when you sort of have a bill that says a percentage, you need to know what the percentage of what is. And candidly, we don't know what the percentage is of our total LIHEAP funds until frequently, you know, into January or February. And that's so that's one of those kinds of questions. Sometimes we'll receive, like, we'll receive funds as late as, you know, the end of January and February, and sometimes as late as the end of the federal fiscal year as they clean out their books for a calendar year.
Thank you. It seems to me then that Ms. Marshall is going to want to take advantage of buying propane when the propane is less expensive, and that by saving back some of the money, it would make sense to save that amount of money on propane. Is there are there years that the federal government comes back, or the state, we have appropriated more money in cold years, that we could accumulate a reserve without having that third that we're holding back from people in a bad year? My concern is, what's going to happen? We're running out of money for propane, and we have a third reserve back left over for pre-buy. I hate to see people get cold. Director Garvey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Gunther, we do not oppose this bill. We do not oppose pre-buy for propane. The issue that we're trying to explore is, how do we make sure we can do a holdback in a way that doesn't, to use the phrase, rob Peter to pay Paul, or puts us in a position where we don't know exactly what our holdback number is. And what I was hoping to do was to work with Ms. Marshall and Author Hilty to address these concerns, because I think they can be readily addressed as we move this bill forward.
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair and Representative Gunther, I think that concern is one we have as well. It's the problem of the scarcity of resources. Our point is, given the scarcity of resources, how will we best spend them? It's also true, again, that the department consistently carries $4-6 million forward from one year to the next, so it's not like we're shutting people off from getting assistance in the current winter. The program typically shuts down in April, and we don't reopen the energy assistance program again until the fall, and that $6 million is sitting there, and I think we should use it for this.
Madam Chair. The $6 million that Ms. Marshall is referring to is a portion of the $105 million that we received this year, which is significantly more than we normally receive under the LAHEAP program. It's also being held back because I've made the decision to hold it back. As a result of that decision, there will be households that will not receive heating assistance because of that holdback. That is not because we have exhausted the need. It's because a decision was made to hold back money for this. It's not an automatic component. We do not ever run out of money, run out of households that don't need money. It's a decision that you make in how you operate the program.
Further questions? Representative Narnik?
Yeah, just a couple here. This bill specifically talks about propane. Is there something similar that we do with heating oil? Or are we able to pre-buy that? And I assume some of your heating assistance goes to buy heating oil as well.
Director Garvey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Norris. Yes, and I will actually hand out to the committee a summary of a lot of numbers and give you a fuel type. Propane is one. We'll give heating assistance for wood. We'll give heating assistance for heating oil. We don't have a lot of heating oil in Minnesota. I mean, it's very, very small. Most of our non-connected is either propane or some of wood, but heating oil is not a particularly heavily used fuel in the heating fuel in the state of Minnesota.
Okay.
Ms. Marshall,
if I could, Madam Chair, Representative, about 10% of the energy assistance LIHEAP population heats with fuel oil. And I think there are steps that can be taken to help mitigate against what is right now $3.18 a gallon.
Yeah, I know it's very expensive.
And a few years back when pre-buy was first starting, we did have a summer fill component where we used some of the LIHEAP funds to purchase one tank full on behalf of some of the low-income households that heat with fuel oil.
Okay. Madam Chair, just one other comment, I guess, not a question, but as far as the heating assistance program goes, I would like to see at some point we address the issue of the cutoff point. I had a constituent this year that made just slightly more money than was allowed, and she lost her heating assistance. And for her, that was a tremendous hit because of just being over the line. And it'd be nice if there was sort of a gradual cutoff rather than that quick. So we can deal with that some other day. But. Yeah.
Further comments, questions? Representative Westham.
Madam Chair, to Mr. Garvey, what has been the history of pre-buy? Have we, a couple of years we've had it, have we hit the market good in speculating, or has it ended up that we've paid more than other times of the year by doing it? What's been the record?
Director Garvey.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Westrom, pre-buy has not been done every year, so there are just a few years of specific data. We, the Department of Commerce, did it last winter. The increased volatility of the propane fuels has made the pre-buy on a massive across the state basis. some win, some lose. It's been done in the past. I think Energy Sense, Penn Marshall did it, and they had a better record. But the increased volatility of propane prices makes pre-buy on a statewide basis, making sure everyone wins, harder to do, harder to assure. We think it's worth trying and we think it's worth doing, but we do sort of want to make sure that it's not an automatic win opportunity.
Senator Westrom.
Well, Madam Chair and members, and I think Ms. Marshall and Mr. Garvey, I remember when this bill went through a few years ago, and I mean, that's, I think generally it makes sense, but I know that I at least remember reading one information sheet or fact sheet that talked about July wasn't so cheap a couple of years ago, and it would have actually been cheaper to buy in October, November than it was in the summer. And we all struggle with that ourselves in our own individual choices. And this fall was the same way. If I had waited 2-3 more weeks, to the end of November, I'd have saved about 20-30 cents a gallon on my heating oil. And in fact, I had been waiting, and then I was on auto fill and hadn't gotten a hold of the company in time. And so, I mean, I just illustrate that because I think it's a tough challenge to have state government programs trying to play the market when we all know for a winner, you've got to have a loser in the marketplace. And trends are one thing, but there's a lot of skilled investors that I know have lost everything they've gained by trying to play the trends and gamble that they're going to beat the trends every year, and it just doesn't happen. So that's just a concern I've had, and I think this has to be a pretty balanced approach to going ahead with this.
Representative Helsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I noted initially, plan is to lay this bill over. As always, I'm happy to work with Director Garvey to find ideal solutions to difficult problems. We can get the Department of Commerce to quit relying so much on the EIA for its prognostications. Perhaps we can do better with the propane pre-purchases as well. But in any case, we will work together in the next few days to make sure that we get this bill in the best form that we can. I think we all agree that something needs to be done. And frankly, I think that this is a problem that's going to become more and more severe in coming years as we deal with constraints in the global energy markets. So we'll work on this, and Madam Chair, I'm sure that Director Garvey will be happy to work out a solution.
Thank you, Representative Hilton, and thank you, Ms. Marshall and Director Garvey, for your comments. Members, we will be in recess on the call of the chair. We expect to come back. My understanding is around 5:30. We do have caucus, so 6:30. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Six. I stand corrected.
Madam Chair, I was hoping that would be possible that it would be possible to reconvene at 6:00.
Okay.
Make that tentatively, and if it turns out that's not going to be possible, we will notify members as soon as possible, but I think that's realistic.
Thank you, and my understanding is we will reconvene in this room.
That's correct.
Okay, so House File 3578 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Finance Bill, and we will recess until 6 o'clock. Thank you.
We will call the meeting of the Energy Policy and Finance Division back to order. Representative Kalin, your bill, House File 3669.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3669 to have it before the committee.
Very well. Representative Kalin, I believe you have a amendment to the bill. Do you want to consider that first?
I do indeed. It's a DE1 amendment, Mr. Chair. And I will move the DE1 amendment and ask that you support it to get the bill in the shape I would like it.
Very well. Representative Kalin moves adoption of the DE1 amendment. Is there any discussion to that amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of its adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment is adopted. Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it too early to call the question? Mr. Chair and members, as you know, last year we passed a strong bipartisan bill, the Next Generation Energy Act, which included the Demand Efficiency Act, setting a nation-leading goal of reduction of energy savings of 1.5% in electricity and natural gas across all sectors. Now we see that we have a wonderful group of partners helping us achieve those goals, from our utilities, from the IOU to the co-ops and the munis, to our local school districts, business owners, and across the board. What we need to do is continue to provide them more tools to achieve these energy saving projects, and House File 3669, as amended, represents a significant tool that we can provide to local units of government and to state agencies. With me
is one of the brain trusts of the of this bill, Sheldon Strom from Center for Energy and Environment. We'll ask to briefly present portions of the bill, and then we'll hand it over to Jeremy DeFebres from the Office of Energy Security, also known as MOES.
Thanks, sir. Thanks very much. My name is Sheldon Strom. I'm with the Center for Energy and Environment. We're a nonprofit that's been doing work in energy efficiency, renewable energy, and energy policy for over 25 years. I'm pleased to support this bill. As Representative Kalin said, the bill you passed last year set these very aggressive energy efficiency goals. And we've been trying to figure out every strategy we can to help achieve those goals. And one important part of that is to help government really lead and set an example on how to achieve these goals. And we've been working with the what we used to call the Department of Commerce, we now call the Office of Energy Security, since last fall on trying to develop a strategy that would provide another option for local governments to more effectively save energy. And that's resulted in the bill that's before you. We've also been working with the League of Minnesota Cities and the School Board Association, who support the bill. They were here earlier to testify in favor of the bill, but they can't be here right now. And what the bill does conceptually is very simple. It provides another financing option in addition to the options that are already out there. And it does it in a way that partners the bill with some very easy-to-use financial or technical assistance to make it simple for local governments to decide on the best conservation measures and to get some help packaging those measures in an easy-to-use package that will allow them to make some investments that will yield cost-effective energy savings. The basic idea here is that we would try and structure these projects so that the savings from the projects will pay off the cost alone. And this is a project that would focus specifically just on energy improvements. It's not like some other lease purchase arrangements that include non-energy improvements. So the whole purpose of this is to provide another option for local governments to save energy. And I think the best thing probably in terms of going through the bill is to have Jeremy DeFebre from the department do that. I think he's been most instrumental in actually working out the language.
Mr. DeFebre. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, barely on the plural, but members on the left. My name is Jeremy DeFebre. I do work at the Office of Energy Security at the Department of Commerce. And I'd just like to preface before we go through the bill part by part that the philosophy of the bill and the program is trying to address what we've identified over time as the most significant barrier to doing energy efficiency improvements in public buildings. They boil down to a lack of capacity to do either technical analysis or assess other technical analysis for energy improvements in a school or municipality. That's not their core business often, and they have, while they have facilities people, they are often already both busy and often don't have the training to assess these kinds of improvements. Additionally, if you are looking at finding money for energy improvements, again, core business is, you know, what school districts, what cities are most interested in doing, and when they have to compete for financing, often energy efficiency improvements end up down too far on the list to actually be done. Thirdly is perception of risk. Quite often, you know, a school board or a city council might be approached with a package of measures that are proposed and that on the surface look like they will provide a good cash flow and not really negatively impact the bottom line. But the question for the decision makers is, how well can we trust that? Because we're not in a position to adequately assess that information, and we're the ones that end up having to deal with the shortfalls of the impact on the bottom line if it doesn't happen. So there's a model out there under 123B.65 and 471.345 that is guaranteed energy savings contract. And the theory of those is similar to the approach we're taking here. However, our concern has been that there are sectors in public buildings that are not adequately being served by those approaches, so we felt that there was a need for additional tools for state and local government buildings in order to reach the level of investment in energy efficiency that we need to get to very quickly in order to make the goals that we've set for ourselves. So if that was not as brief a preface as I thought it might be, but it was a preface. I was half right.
Things tend to get away from us.
Yeah. If I go through very quickly, part by part, we are modifying 16D, which governs Department of Administration activities, in order to establish program for state buildings. The definitions, energy improvement project is reasonably self-explanatory. It's the energy project study is something that many of you may have been familiar with as deemed an energy audit, or it's a high-quality technical analysis of buildings' energy-using systems and potential savings. Yeah. Financing agreement is we are looking at, rather than financing using state money or local money, we would be using private tax-exempt lease financing agreements, and within the state program in 16D, we would be proposing doing master leasing in order to provide the most flexibility to Department of Administration to manage that program. In the Section 2, establishing the commission's authority and the authority of state agencies to enter into the contracts for the purposes of this program establishes that this is a voluntary program, that this is an option offered to state agencies in order to improve their buildings, but they are not being required to enter into it. In Subdivision 3, we are attempting both to recover some of the costs of this program because it's predicated on being able to continue to revolve the limited funds that are available to continue offering this program in subsequent years. We also will target the highest likelihood saving using D3 benchmarking tool. We hope to identify those that are the unperforming buildings and first look there for savings as having the biggest bang for the buck. We'll solicit under Subdivision 4 financing master agreements from one or more lease purchase financing, either, you know, typically the state has entered into those with entities such as Wells Fargo or other banks. We provide qualifying energy improvements have to meet certain standards under Subdivision 5, including technical and economic feasibility and positive cash flow for efficiency measures or reduction in fossil fuels for renewable measures. The Subdivision Program 6 program costs specify that those costs for the program not financed under the lease purchase financing agreements that are made will be paid through the funds that are appropriated later in this bill. In Section 3, there is language that was at the behest of Representative Kalin and some of the utility representatives. Do you want to?
Just briefly, Section 3 is language just to confirm that that the utility can count as direct savings under their agreed-upon goals with the department under our Demand Efficiency Act. The energy savings activities projects that they are partnering with the state and local units of government on, in this position, the state. It's both sections, sorry. It's the state and the local units of government. So I want to make sure the utilities can count the good work that they do under these agreements.
Thank you. That's your decision.
Moving on to Section 4, amendments to 216C. In 216C.09, we strike a requirement that has been on the books since 1988 that the commissioner adopt rules for programs using petroleum violation escrow funds, which is the source of funding for this program. The reason for striking that is that there's a very long explanation having to do with the court order governing those and underlying the Department of Energy interpretation of that and previous legislation related to it, but we can't use these petroleum violation escrow dollars for administrative costs like administrative rules. So if we were to keep this here, it would be a general fund expenditure of somewhere in the range of $75,000 to $100,000. So our choice was to strike that requirement. There are no other petroleum violation escrow funds that would be governed by this at this point anyway. And that's what the feds have told us, that there are no more forthcoming. That well is finally dry.
We should probably also observe that this particular element avoids a stop at the Government Operations Committee.
Not that anyone would have thought of that. May have come up with that strategy. I'm a simple bureaucrat. I wouldn't have thought of that. definitions. We have similar definitions for many things in as we've defined them in 16B for the state program. We do, however, introduce an element of a guarantee in the local government program, and I should back up and say we didn't think that was necessary at the state level because we would be reassuring ourselves that we would actually cover our underruns if we were if they should happen. So we felt that was if we couldn't reassure ourselves some other way, it would probably not work as providing some sort of guarantee either. Getting into some of the other similar programs, we establish authority for both commissioner and local governments to participate in contracts for this. Again, program participation is entirely voluntary. A local government may elect to access this, but there is no requirement that they do. We will again prioritize technical services to those entities that in D3 benchmarking tool demonstrate that they are underperforming and therefore most likely to have high quality savings most achievable. We intend to act to have most of the program operation administration at a subcontract level, and we're authorized under Subdivision 3 to do that. We, under Subdivision 4, we are authorized to provide the targeted technical services and to both contract for that with one or more provider and to require full or partial reimbursement of those technical services from a local government based on terms and conditions that are agreed to prior to providing those services. We also allow that local governments could independently get technical services as long as we then can review and approve those that they meet the standards for technical services that we need in order to feel comfortable in doing a guarantee and that the financial entity feels comfortable with in providing the financing. One of the intents in this program is to build capacity, technical capacity in the state. We are looking at, I think, a shortage of both architectural and engineers and energy auditors that are capable of doing the kind of technical assessments and recommissioning work that we anticipate will be needed for this. So part of our purpose is to do capacity building in those sectors. We want to work with those folks to be able to provide those services, both within public buildings and then more broadly in commercial and other buildings. We will solicit a proposal from private financial institutions is to provide template financial terms that will be universally available to every participant. And this allows us to, in aggregate, provide the best terms available, whether it is a Minneapolis, which could very easily get very good terms on its own, or whether it is a Center City, which because of its size, may not be able to get as good a term. And it will also help reduce some of the transaction costs by providing template financing. The positive budget impact is one of the keys to the program. And because we have a limited source of money, it's a somewhat artful approach. Convoluted would be another word, but I wouldn't want to use that one. We, in a typical guaranteed energy savings contract, the contractor will say, if you are short of the energy savings that we say you're going to provide, we'll hand you the cash to make up the difference. We don't have that much cash to hand around, so we need to be able to take another approach, which says we're going to guarantee that your cash flow will be positive during the period of the guarantee term. So if you're spending $100 annually on your financing and you only get $99 of savings out of this, we will help you cash flow so that your bottom line isn't impacted during that period. We'll loan you money. But after you're done paying off your financing, you're going to have to give us the money back. So unless for some reason, which will, of course, never happen, everything falls apart, and people never get positive cash flow, that would be a point where we would have to then say, it's yours. It's a loan that's forgiven. But it's because of the very limited resources we have, we needed to come up with a system that both provided that risk mitigation to the borrowers, but also allowed us to continue to recover and continue to revolve these funds for use. The reason these funds existed is that they were put in a revolving loan program to begin with in 1986, and rather than spent as a direct expenditure for program or grant. So we wanted to continue that approach. Again, we define qualifying energy improvements and provide for certain requirements that they need to meet. The program costs can be paid out of the appropriation that are not direct costs of implementing the energy improvements, and appropriation of funds from the petroleum violation escrow funds, $1 million of it goes going to the Department of Administration for the program under 16B, and the remainder to the commissioner for the program proposed in 216C. And in order to affect that, those funds were appropriated for a K-12 grant program last session, and that is repealed.
Thank you, Mr. Zebras. Representative Kalin, do you have others that wish to testify?
I don't, in support of the bill, but I do understand that representatives from Johnson Controls and Honeywell are both here to add to the conversation. All right, I think at least one.
Before we go to the other testifiers, are there questions from members for Mr. Strom or Mr. DeFeber? Seeing none, then proceed with the opposition.
Yes. Good evening, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Kevin Madden. I'm the Vice President of Worldwide Sales for Honeywell. I'm based here in Golden Valley, Minnesota.
And I'm Jim Girard with Cook Hill Girard, and I'm representing Johnson Controls this evening because the folks that were here this afternoon had to leave for some meetings they had. So I'm going to turn it back to Mr. Madden, and then I'll pretty much agree with him, I think.
You think? Tough for us to agree. Honeywell and Johnson, so we come here in a cooperative spirit tonight. But again, just want to be real clear that the intent of the legislation is good, especially today when oil is cresting to $100 a barrel. The intent is good here. Some of the areas that were outlined previous
and some of the areas we're concerned with on behalf of Honeywell and Johnson Controls are the following. It forces the state versus the private sector to guarantee the energy performance with no upper limit to the dollar amount that's going to be saved. So, which could be quite expensive to the state if, in essence, you miss. So that today is borne by the private sector. Secondly, it forces the state to guarantee the energy performance as well as the performance of the equipment over time with no performance bonds or no backstop if things go awry. Again, quite expensive venture for the state to enter into if you have a performance problem with the equipment when it's installed or you have a savings shortfall. By requiring the competitive bidding process, it sometimes may force the state to choose the lowest cost providers that are not qualified and may not be able to provide the best value in terms of the most energy saved. One of the things that was talked about earlier was the technical analysis up front. And 1986 was a real benchmark in the energy services and energy service companies industry, where we really started forming around this industry. And we have over 100 in the U.S. alone, 100 performance contracting engineers up front that do the feasibility and design, do the assessment of the facilities up front, and in turn, then once that feasibility and design is done, the risk assessments are done, then we'll start moving down the path of preparing a program for installation. Once installed, the key component of that is the serviceability of that over the life cycle of that equipment. Most equipment that's installed will last for an average of 15 to 20 years. The example the Corps of Engineers used on the federal agreement with the Army and the Department of Defense sites is clearly driven around the sustainability. So when after the contracts are over, that you hand over equipment that is in workable condition, that's providing the intent of the program a safe, a comfortable, and productive environment for the people on those posts, or the people in the state buildings, municipalities, whatever it may be. But it was intent that you leave this equipment in top shape before you leave. So as an ESCO, what we have to do a lot of times is, in essence, replace that equipment through the life cycle. So if it fails prematurely at 7 years, we own it, we fix it, we replace it at no cost to the government. So it's a key component of the program, and again, it takes the risk off the state. Other key areas, again, the administrivia of these programs is extreme in terms of the number of people to administer not only the feasibility aspects, but the backside, the M&V, the measurement and verification of the savings. In the case of where a savings is not met, we in essence write the check to balance the books. We don't do that often, because quite frankly we do a lot of the homework up front. It's a 6 to 9 month process of homework up front prior to doing the installation. So really key areas. Some of the key states that are driving legislative change, and again, the intent of what is being done here is to be applauded. States like Massachusetts are really putting more teeth and accountability into the program. Delaware, Pennsylvania, Illinois. So really, our intent here today is to piggyback on current legislation that's in place, maybe bolster it and put more accountability in terms of the execution and really driving meaningful savings for the state of Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman and committee members, we thank you for the opportunity to present and talk to you tonight.
Mr. Gerard, do you have anything to add?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just point out that both Johnson Controls and Honeywell have millions of dollars in performance contracts around the state right now with school districts, with cities, with MinSCU, University of Minnesota, doing a lot of, and I don't think people realize how big it is, and I don't have the numbers at my fingertips, but it's a huge amount of money, and there's many, many projects that have been successfully done that are paying off in the manner in which the original contract was intended. So it's a system that's working very well now, and I think one of the things everybody should be aware of is you don't want to do anything to really mess up what is working now. So that's the goal I think we're all working towards.
Well, gentlemen, if I understand your testimony correctly, you're at least sympathetic with the overall goals of the bill. It's not entirely enthusiastic about some of its details, and I wonder if you have suggestions for how it might be improved
then?
I think we do in terms of some of the suggestions, but again, put the liability and the risk on the private sector is absolutely key. Again, with the performance backstop in terms of the equipment over the life cycle, that ensures, and I guess the Corps of Engineers did it really well, and they held our feet to the fire in terms of installing the equipment, and they had 25-year contracts. So that equipment will fail once or twice through the life of that contract. So they ensure that we replace that equipment if it fails prematurely or at the eventual end of that life cycle. So putting some real teeth in there, in essence, and putting that liability where it belongs, out in the public, out in the private sector.
Mr. Chairman, I also think that one of the things that would help is to make sure that whatever's done here fits in with the existing performance contracting legislation, with the guaranteed savings energy contracting statutes that exist, so that people can understand how the process works, what their options are. Well, when a city decides that they might want to upgrade a building and make it more energy efficient, so that it all fits together and is understandable, and that when that city or school district decides to do it, that they know what each piece means and what they're getting if they go with this piece of legislation or with some of the existing legislation, the existing statutes. And I've been working on this. We've changed from 10 to 15 years in several areas, the length of time for performance contracting in the last few years. And there's quite a few different areas of statute that this exists in. But it's a little bit confusing, and it's scattered around throughout the statute. So I think whatever can be done to make it understandable and fit together for the people that are going to use it would be important.
Thank you. Are there questions for these witnesses? Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. Representative Kalin, I'd be interested in your response to these concerns, especially the relationship between your proposal and private sector performance contracts.
Representative Kalin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Reinert. We had a good discussion a couple of days ago, I can't remember, with Johnson Controls. Mr. Madden and I haven't had a chance to have more than a 5 or 10 minute cursory conversation about a separate business opportunity I'm hoping that they'll engage on. But if I can actually buttress Mr. Gerard's case for a second for Johnson Controls, we learned that the energy savings mandate that we passed and enacted into law and was signed by the governor in 2007 has been one of the sparks that has led to Johnson Controls nationwide to needing to add employment of 50,000 employees. That's across the nation, not just in Minnesota, I believe, but...
Actually, that's international.
International, excuse me.
About 25,000 in the U.S.
Okay, 25, so half of that in the United States. You know, we can certainly, I'm going to ask them to drill down when we meet on Friday, a little bit more detail about the impact in Minnesota, but we know there's $160 million of guarantees out there that you for Johnson Controls alone, and I'm sure Mr. Madden will be able to ultimately provide us with more hard numbers on Honeywell's impact and the other ESCOs. I think that there's more than enough work to go around. I think, we're going to continue to try to address the concerns about the guarantee issue and this issue of making sure that energy savings promised or energy savings delivered. And this is an issue not only with the ESCOs and with our bill, but also across the implementation of the Demand Efficiency Act and the SIP program, but also across the entire sector of energy conservation and efficiency. We can put up one of Representative Turbin's 2 megawatt Peterson. Getting that backwards. But we can put up a 2 megawatt turbine that's going to stick a lot easier over time, going to maintain its power generation than saving 2 megawatts of ultimate demand. But to save those 2 megawatts requires a lot of person hours on the ground to continue to operate and maintain verify savings. I think on the measurement and verification issue, we have a good foundation that I think we need to learn more about the technical stickiness of it, but the Buildings Benchmarks and Beyond tool that we heard about with Chair Hilty's bill, the 2030 bill, that identifies those measures the use of energy in our local government buildings as well as state buildings. And in fact, we think that almost every state building is now on board from what we're hearing from admin. So I think that we may have tools on the ground to continue to do that verification and measurement that is really important so that we know that these projects work. You know, the impact of our bill would be about a 20th of the existing market that's going to continue to grow. And I think that just philosophically, I think that it's the I think some of the concerns about Honeywell and Johnson Controls and the other ESCOs, they can actually compete and probably quite successfully for some of the services that we're setting up. And I also think that we've really only begun to scratch the surface on all the energy savings and the job opportunities and the financial impact. And I'm hoping to make Honeywell a big chunk of change here in the next few years with some other ideas. So I feel like we're in this together and that we're going to resolve these issues, and they're fairly minor.
Further questions from members? Gentlemen, thank you. Representative Kalin, Mr. Pomeroy reminds me that this bill was initially referred to finance, which was then re-referred to this division. So in order to move the bill, we will have to return it to this finance committee with the recommendation that it be re-referred to local government, which would be the appropriate motion. But before we do that, of course, this is a finance division, and presumably the reason that it was referred initially to the finance committee was the funding provision that's in the final section, section 6, or not the final section, but section 6, subdivision 10.
Yes.
Do you want to address that briefly, Representative Kalin?
I will indeed, Chair Hilty. The funds, as I think were referred to, the funding source that Mr. DeCivri referred to is actually some oil overcharge funds that that were initially intended. They're part of a federal settlement with Exxon, and now Exxon Mobil, of course, that were originally intended. Actually, I have an article from 1986 that shows that
I understand they're kind of strapped for cash, Representative Kalin.
Well, the interesting thing about Exxon, about this fund, is that actually it's a one-time appropriation that or there are certainly no more funds available coming from ExxonMobil for this purchase unless this legislature were to find a way to act in a totally independent from the manner totally independent from this bill. But the Legislative Commission on Energy that formerly has since turned into the Legislative Electric Energy Task Force, that I believe we may be returning the word commission and substance to that body, did recommend that these funds be used for conservation loans for public buildings. So it's an idea whose time came and passed and has come again. And I believe that the act taken in Chapter 57 of Law 2007 was a good step, but that there are some hurdles that needed to get cleared up. And I think in order for local units of government and school districts to take advantage of those funds, and I think that this bill actually does that, and I appreciate very much the department most and the Center for Energy and the Environment helping us resolve those issues and make these funds actually stretch much, much further. It's in essence a revolving loan fund, but with some more complicated mechanism for many reasons. I hope that answers your question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you, Representative Kalin. Are there further questions for the author? And is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Kalin, I believe your motion is to recommend that the bill be passed and referred to the Committee on Finance with a recommendation that it be re-referred to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you, Representative Kalin. The motion is before us. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is returned to the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Bly, we promised people that wish to testify in House File 3537 that they would be given that opportunity. We have at least four testifiers remaining. If you would like to move your bill to be before us, we will entertain that testimony.
Do I renew my motion, or just say move that
Representative Bly, I believe at this time we will complete the testimony, but
okay.
I do intend to, I think there are some possible amendments to the bill that have been suggested, and not for this evening. We will take the remaining testimony and lay the bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus energy bill.
Okay. So I move my bill. I'm also wondering, Chair, if I could have Paul Blackburn join me here in case there are questions that I need to turn to him to help for some answers.
Certainly. So with that, Mr. Sundberg, you're first on the list. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm not sure, do you want to have two economist types up here at the same time? Okay. Both be right and both be wrong at the same time? And, you know, never know what's going to happen.
We'll take our chance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lee Sundberg with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. I represent the 44 nonprofit member-owned distribution co-ops and the six generation and transmission cooperative. They range in size from, we have a couple at 2,000 and one in the metro area at 120,000. Our median size is 6,400. We cover or serve about 85 to 90% of the geographic area of the state with as few as 1.6 customers for a mile of distribution line. Co-ops want to succeed in implementing the 25% renewable energy standard at the lowest possible cost. And our preliminary studies that we show that we hope to be, we will be meeting as we go along that mandate at a modest price increase to our consumers. That's, again, preliminary studies looking at different variables, inputs. We anticipate or hoping that the price would be very modest. House File 3537 is just the opposite. It makes achievement of the mandate more difficult and at a much higher cost as we see it. Not only will the co-ops have higher or new costs of PUC, Public Utility Commission regulation, now we will be forced, rather than competitively negotiating rates, will be forced to enter into very uneconomical long-term contracts that intentionally raise rates to other consumers. Raising rates so that a non-profit co-op can guarantee a profit for another business is just incomprehensible to us. And cost recovery is not the answer for us. It's not a solution when, for us, the issue is just plain cost. Under the state PURPA law, Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act, the co-op, because of the large geographic area that we serve, we get the vast majority of the small qualifying facilities, the QFs. And we naturally think that that will be the case again here. The average household income in our service territory outside of the metro area is about 73% of the state median income. The lowest co-op is at 58%. And in a small co-op system with only 1 to 3 local distribution co-ops, the rate increase among a small number of customers, if the PGM rate is spread out at all, will undoubtedly be very high. We're not talking millions of customers here. We're talking a couple thousand to spread this rate. For example, in Minnesota Valley Co-op in Montevideo, Mr. Peterson's district, it's one distribution co-op that's served by one G&T. It's a big G&T, but they serve off in different states. Well, they only serve one co-op in Minnesota. And that co-op has 5,300 customers with 1.6 customers per mile of line and is at about 70% of the state median income. Another way of looking at this is that the G&Ts and the local distribution co-op are obviously very different entities. And the G&T has no control over the local co-op distribution system or over its rates. So, for example, the provision to file rates with the Public Utilities Commission is a requirement of each of the 44 distribution co-ops, not the G&T, because only the distribution co-op provides retail service. A G&T cannot file retail rates for the distribution co-op. Another example is the provision on page 7 concerning interconnection costs of the distribution system. Again, this is an expense of that local co-op, not the G&T, and there is no free plug-and-play. The bill contains no safety valve or limit to the indirect tax imposed on this bill, leaving any business, whether it's profit or non-profit, very vulnerable. One way of putting it, my local Ace Hardware sells at retail a hammer for $10. The wholesale price of the hammer under this bill is not $5, say, but rather $12.50 or $15. So in other words, the wholesale rate is higher, and in some cases 7 times higher than the retail rate. We cannot stay in business very long at that rate. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for Mr. Sundberg? Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. And to Mr. Sundberg, can you please repeat those last numbers that you used about wholesale and retail and put it in context of what the current wholesale rate is and what it will go to?
Chairman, Representative Welty, using the example of the Ace Hardware hammer, translate, you want me to translate that into wholesale electric cost? The wholesale cost now is about 4 to 6 cents. Our average retail rate is 8 cents. Some of the prescribed rates in the bill go up to minimum, at least, because it doesn't count interconnection costs and other costs that would go on top of the prescribed rate in here of, 69 plus a minimum 10% on top for a solar unit. So that's buying wholesale more than the 8 cents retail. Hope, did that answer your question, Representative Wilson?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Chair Hilton and Mr. Thunberg. I'm trying to just get a clear estimate of what you're saying here. Okay, so you said before the wholesale currently is 4 to 6 cents. The average retail is 8 cents. Under this legislation, what would the wholesale be and what would the retail then be? Can you give that to me?
Well, Representative Welty, the retail, the wholesale is prescribed in the bill at a given rate for 1 kilowatt hour of the various types, plus minimum 10% profit, plus the interconnection cost. That now a developer is responsible for based on Public Utility Commission rules for up to 10 megawatts. And now if I read the bill correctly, the local distribution co-op would be responsible for picking up those costs. And they don't come cheap sometimes. It takes some engineering studies to determine whether that facility can fit into the system. And I think we know that. They know that. That's why it can become expensive.
Okay. Representative Wells. Thank you, Chair Hilty. And to Mr. Thunberg, I appreciate you giving me the base numbers of 4 to 6 cents for wholesale and average retail of 8 cents. And then giving me the numbers of the minimum of 10% profit. I know I read that in the bill. And then talking about the interconnection cost of how it is now and how it will be. It would be beneficial, I think, though, to also kind of have an apples-to-apples number if you could possibly put that together. I'm not saying I'm expecting it tonight or anything, but to help make the case and to make it more clear, it'd be nice to have actual numbers where you're saying, okay, the wholesale is 4 to 6 cents now, but under this legislation, it's going to be 6 to 7 or 7 to 8 or whatever. And I'm not hearing that. So it makes it difficult for us to base a decision on when we don't know where you're going with the number. So I'm just going to leave it at that, and it's just something for you to think about. But I appreciate what you pointed out here, and hopefully we'll be able to get to some numbers.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, and possibly your answer may come with another one of the testifiers from Great River Energy.
Further questions for Mr. Thunberg? Representative Briner.
Thank you, Chair Hilty. I just want to comment on Representative Hilty's question. I don't know that one can answer that question because you would have to know what the proportion is of all these alternative energy sources is feeding into the grid and how that compares to the overall energy available in the grid before you can come up with that figure. Clearly it's going to raise costs, but it could be by a minuscule amount if it's only contributing a very small portion of the energy. The comparison is to the entire amount of energy being used on the grid. I mean, that's my understanding.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Breinhardt, that was my point in saying that this is not distributed among a large universe. Your point is well taken. Yes, but I was just saying, on the other side, for many of the co-ops, it's a small universe. Yeah.
Representative Peters.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Sundberg. In other bills, and over the years, in the 5-6 years that passed the Renewable Energy Standard, your group is the most opposed of any utility that bothers to come to the committee and participate in the conversation on renewable energy. And by far, you guys have been the most against this. But in the seabed statute, we put in language, paragraphs here and there, that say co-ops encourage to participate. Members who would like to participate, would like to get involved with this distribution level, where these lines, these 100 kV and under lines and the distribution lines are.
and this feed-in idea, target, it is for those areas. I'm just wondering at what point, since you did not get exempted from the New Rural Energy Standard, like some other states exempted the rural electric co-ops, and you were not successful in being exempted, that at what point, I think, are you guys going to get involved and maybe talk to some of the members of your distribution co-ops that are not on your boards of directors and go out and see the demand and the desire to get involved with renewable energy at the distribution level in rural Minnesota? Because, you know, I grew up out there, and I've been here for 6 years. Your opposition to renewable energy is the biggest disappointment that I've had being elected. The biggest one. You guys could change the whole deal, and you don't want to do it.
Care to respond, Mr. Thunberg?
Let me just add that we did not attempt to be exempted from the renewable energy objective. We worked with it. We did oppose going to a mandate, but other than that.
Seeing no further questions for Mr. Thunberg, we should move on. Mr. Franklin, next on our list. Franklin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mike Franklin. I'm the Director of Energy Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We represent 2,400 member companies across the state of Minnesota. Our members appreciate the opportunity to provide the business customer perspective on House File 3537. It should come as no surprise to members of this committee to hear that Minnesota businesses rely on our state's traditionally competitive electric rates and have been and are very nervous about rising costs. And while we recognize that energy costs and prices are likely to continue increasing in coming years, our members are hopeful that Minnesota utilities can continue to provide competitively priced electricity and even minimize increases relative to other parts of the country as we meet the REF as well as other goals and mandates. And it's because of this expectation that we have concerns about House File 3537. It appears to us that the rates set by this bill for some new projects appear to be significantly above market rates, even for comparable technologies, and that's, of course, from the perspective of the customer, the end user. This, to us, essentially amounts to a state law requiring utilities to agree to above-market projects and then to pass the increases along to the ratepayer, who has no choice of provider. In doing so, we feel we would reduce Minnesota companies' competitiveness in their marketplace and make Minnesota a less attractive place to locate for any new large electric customers. Another concern from the customer's perspective is that this bill would likely reduce the pressure on providers to meet Minnesota's RES obligations in the most competitive manner possible. As you all know, ensuring that the RES can be met while keeping our rates competitive was a major concern of the Chamber when the RES was being debated. By statutorily setting minimum rates for some projects and guaranteeing a profit of not less than 10% per year, our fear is that there would be a statutory disincentive for energy producers to offer a competitively priced product to Minnesota customers. And as you've heard from other testifiers and as we fear as well, this could have the effect of meeting the RES at a much higher cost to our state's economy. To us, this does not seem consistent with the provisions of the RES that give customers assurance that its implementation will not cause a significant rate impact. Doing so would appear also to deprive the PUC of the tools to work towards that outcome. We do share the goal of increasing opportunities for Minnesota citizens and companies to invest and participate in the growing renewable energy marketplace. And just as one example, we did work with the Department of Commerce and Utilities over the interim on ways to make it easier for larger customers to finance ownership of their own off-site renewable distributed generation. And we appreciate this committee's decision last year to undertake that study. In the future, we hope to work together with you on ways to improve Minnesota's economy
and as we do so, we would urge the committee and legislators to consider ways to keep Minnesota's rates competitive as one factor in attracting new businesses to Minnesota and encouraging existing businesses to grow here. At this time, however, we do not believe that House File 3537 helps to achieve that objective. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be happy to answer any questions by members.
Thank you, Mr. Franklin. Are there questions for the testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Franklin.
Thank you.
Mr. Engelchen? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engelking, and I'm manager of resource planning and bidding for Xcel Energy. I'm going to try not to repeat testimony you've already heard tonight. I can start out by pointing out that in December of this year, Xcel Energy filed with the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission a comprehensive resource plan that was designed to meet the renewable energy standard passed by this legislature last year, substantially improve our emissions footprint in our service territory, and reduce our carbon dioxide emissions by 22% by over 2005 levels by 2020. Based on our assumptions in putting this plan together, this plan will cost less than any alternative plan that will not achieve those goals. But that plan is based on assumptions. It's based on assumptions such as what our forecast will be, what the cost of different resources will be, what the price of gas will be, the cost of wind. And when those assumptions change, other things change as well. The way that our plan is put together changes. For example, if we increase our estimated cost of wind by 20% over what we assume that it would be in this plan, which we've put forward as our least cost plan to the state of Minnesota, the cost of our plan increases by over $500 million. That's a 20% increase. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the costs that are in this tariff. We have a concern that the floors, and they are floors in this tariff that are being legislated, are far too high. For example, the 10¼ cents for wind that is being proposed for small wind is fully 50% higher than the highest offer we have ever received from anyone to sell us wind. And that's large project, small project, from anyone to sell us wind. And that's large project, small project, seabed project, fully 50% higher than any competitive solicitation we've received. The 8 cents, which is required payment for larger wind, is 40% higher than the cost of our recently announced owned project at the Grand Meadow Wind Farm. One of the concerns that we have is certainly that we want to fulfill our renewable energy standard in the least cost manner, and you've heard, I think, everyone say that. But I think the other thing is that this bill is perhaps misdirected. The barriers that we are seeing to wind development currently have nothing to do with the price that we are willing to pay. In fact, we have met price increase requests from a number of developers because we recognize the difficulties that are happening in the industry right now with turbine supply constraints, interconnection delays, and other reasons. We've been before the Public Utilities Commission a number of times. There's one contract that we've had that has three amendments with different price changes going in. The problem right now is not pricing. There are other barriers to development that we need to solve, barriers such as the transmission queue, such as the turbine constraints. Another concern that we have is that the bill has no cap on the amount of energy that we must take under this. The representative who spoke about this perhaps being a very small portion of our full embedded cost is correct. If it's a very small portion of our embedded cost, it will raise our overall rates only slightly. However, we do have a renewable energy standard of 30%, and this bill doesn't even cap that must-take provision at once we reach our renewable energy standard. It requires us to continue taking all that is offered into the marketplace. If there is a great deal offered into the marketplace and these projects are indeed developed, essentially what we do is we eviscerate all of the provisions that were built into the renewable energy standard to make sure that this could be implemented at a reasonable cost. And it also takes away all of our abilities to use some of the provisions, some of the safeguards that were added to that bill to make sure that we continue to have a reliable system, that we continue to have a system at reasonable cost. Xcel Energy is dedicated to meeting the renewable energy standard, and in fact, we've put forward some very aggressive plans to do so. We believe that it's far more important for us as a state to address the other barriers that are causing wind development to stand still than to legislate pricing that is far above the market that we are seeing right now for wind, even for small wind. I'm available to answer any questions.
Representative Reiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering what your thoughts are about incentivizing the small, you know, energy producer and encouraging that this kind of citizen responsibility in the whole energy cycle. The vision is different. I mean, I understand your issues from a business point of view, but I'm not saying this is the right vehicle or the rates are right or anything, but I'm really concerned that when we focus only on the corporate structure, I mean, there are certain things this is designed to do in terms of reducing your costs, like reducing the need for more generation and more I don't even know all the right terms. I'm sorry, but I'm really concerned about this the need to incentivize more local production and more energy independence in small communities. And I think that's part of the vision behind this structure. So how would you, from your company's perspective, see that we could do that in another format?
Ms. Engelstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative, Xcel Energy has been very supportive of the seabed concept. And one of the things that the seabed concept has done is it has allowed some of these small producers to aggregate and to obtain the same type of pricing and benefits in the marketplace as larger developments get. And in fact, not only do they, you know, can they achieve some of the same economies and some of the same pricing, but given a very favorable tariff structure, they're also open to much more favorable financing needs. I think that we always need to find a balance between the economic development benefits of, say, an individual small producer and the economic development benefits overall of the electricity costs in our state. There is certainly advantages to looking at both sides of those. I think our concern right now is that this bill does not achieve that balance and, in fact, actually encourages us to implement the renewable energy standard in an above-cost manner, in a way that will actually skew that balance away from the state as a whole and towards some individual interests.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. And to Ms. Engelking, I know Xcel has been kind of at the forefront in Minnesota, especially with wind development and renewable energy development. And I'm just wondering, can you tell me numbers, you can't have any solid numbers, as far as out of your total wind portfolio that you have, how many actual contracts you have with seabed projects, or how many contracts you actually have where you've just, you know, purchased wind from a farmer or from a group of farmers or a group of landowners or a group of people who have one turbine or have two turbines or have three? Because I hear a lot in the discussions about wind that, yes, we have these large wind farms moving forward, but the utilities are very apprehensive about going after one turbine or three turbines.
Mr. Chair, Representative Welty, currently Xcel Energy, and I can't give you precise numbers because I don't have all my cheat sheets in front of us, but we have over 80 contracts with developers who have projects that are 2 megawatts or less out of our entire portfolio. Our Minnesota wind portfolio right now is just about 1,000 megawatts. We just exceeded 1,000 megawatts at the end. So we've got over 80 contracts of projects that are 2 megawatts or less, roughly 160 megawatts of those projects. We have 167 megawatts of contracts that we have signed with seabed developers. Now, all of those projects are actually not yet operating. Some of them are up but not operating. Some of them we're still trying to get up. The remainder of the projects are projects that range in from 25 megawatts to 150 or 200 megawatts apiece. And I think that, you know, we have always been looking for the most economic ways to develop, and I think that the state has been looking for that too. The under 2 megawatt law with the renewable energy production incentive wasn't working because the renewable energy production incentive became very expensive. CBET has looked at it to be a replacement for that as a means to try to aggregate projects to get greater benefit and to bring more local investment into those projects.
Further questions for Ms. Engelson? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cervato?
Mr. Chairman, members, good evening. My name is Glenn Skarbaka, and I'm manager of resource planning at Great River Energy. Great River Energy, as you may have heard before, is a generation and transmission cooperative. It's kind of a cooperative of cooperatives that's formed by and serves 28 distribution cooperatives that in turn serve a little over 600,000 member consumers across a wide swath of the state. It's a not-for-profit organization. The costs of running the organization are shared among the members, and the earnings from the operations are returned to them. I guess I was a little surprised at the comment earlier, you know, that Great River Energy isn't in some manner supportive of renewables. That's really contrary to what I encounter in my work. Part of my job is meeting the renewable energy standard, and I can tell you we embrace that and we're working hard to make it happen. By the end of this year, we're going to be three quarters of the way to meeting the 2012 goal of the renewable energy standard. We'll have a little over 300 megawatts of wind generation online. Beyond that, to reach the 25% standard by the year 2025, we're going to need an additional 900 megawatts if we were to meet all of that requirement with wind. Addressing the bill before us, we've got a number of concerns about it. I'm also not going to repeat a number of those you've heard already, given the hour, but I'll highlight a few. One is that we don't see the feed-in tariff as being needed to meet the renewable energy standard. As I mentioned, we need another 900 megawatts of wind generation to meet 25% objective by 2025. Just this last year, we issued a request for proposals for wind and other renewables. In return, we received 3,400 megawatts of proposals with prices under 8 cents, the lowest price specified in the bill before us. That 3,400 megawatts is 3.5 times what GRE would need to meet our additional 900 megawatt requirement by 2025. Of that 3,400 megawatts, about two-thirds are seabed. The project size has varied from a couple of megawatts up to several hundred. So it really represented quite a continuum of different types of projects. Now, not all of them are going to be for real. Not all of them are going to happen, you know, anytime soon. But I think what this indicates is that there are a lot of people out there interested in being in the wind development business, serious enough to provide written proposals to us to meet our needs. We do have concerns that the pricing specified in this legislation is above market, and I'm not going to repeat what you heard earlier. We agree with the earlier testimony. But I do want to comment that the feed-in tariff doesn't necessarily reduce uncertainty, nor does it necessarily lower costs. And these are attributes that this bill is supposed to accomplish. What it does do is it creates an unlimited purchase obligation for utilities at above market prices. And having that unlimited purchase obligation causes uncertainty in and of itself. You know, how much response is there going to be to those above market prices? Whatever there is, we're going to have to take. And then the process of doing that, how many other lower cost resource alternatives are going to be displaced? So what you're doing is you're taking one element of the marketplace, fixing the price for it, but not, you know, not fixing other the prices of other resources that could be displaced in return. Do higher prices and guaranteed profits really incent innovation and competition? There's some doubt about that. Granted, you know, the more wind or other renewables you get out there, you know, the more economies of scale you may get, the more learning curve effects you're going to get. But when you set a floor for pricing that's above the marketplace, at some point you're not going to see much incentive there to lower costs further and to be innovative. Also, by fixing prices, really not dealing with the fact that you're only fixing one element of the marketplace, and the rest of the marketplace is going to be constantly changing. Costs in the supply chain, you know, for producing equipment and for other alternatives are constantly going to be fluctuating. And I guess with a fixed price, you raise the possibility here that the PUC in adjusting those prices in future years isn't going to be able to react quickly enough to changes in the marketplace. And as a result, you're opening up the possibility, the good, strong possibility of unintended consequences if other elements of the market are changing. As to the question about, you know, how much of a rate impact would this really have, Representative Briner, you know, you hit the nail on the head. To answer the question, you really got to figure out the penetration, you know, how many people are going to participate in a program like this. If it's very little, you know, the rate impact's not going to be very, very large. I listened to the testimony for Monday afternoon, and I heard, you know, that something like 1 million Minnesotans could participate in this program. Well, if you got 1 million Minnesotans participating in it, I don't know how many other consumers there are in the state, but that's a pretty big fraction, and the impact's going to be large. Now, clearly, it's going to be something in between. And just the last thing I'd like to offer is that there are still other alternatives for small projects. They're not shut out of the marketplace. There is still net metering. There's PURPA, there's the Minnesota Distributed Generation Statute. All of these are priced based on avoided costs. And if we get in a world where costs are increasing because of carbon regulation or increased commodity prices, increased equipment prices, fuel prices, what have you, the avoided costs are going to rise, and the opportunities presented in an avoided cost regime are also going to increase just organically without any action. And lastly, I just want to mention that these other approaches to small projects are being used. I took a look at three of GRE's member distribution cooperatives, and of the three, I saw 40 small wind projects, photovoltaic projects, and methane projects that are online. You know, they're not getting a lot of profile here, but they are happening without a feed-in tariff, and that was just for three cooperatives. With that, I believe I'll stop.
Thank you, Mr. Scovac. Are there questions for this witness, Representative Welty? Glad you answered this evening.
Thank you, Chairman Welty. And to Mr. Scarbaca?
Yes.
Okay, Mr. Scarbaca, I just wanted to know, out of the 300 megawatts that Great River Energy has or will have online by the end of the year, how many of those megawatts are then from the small projects? You were saying something about 40 megawatts from small projects, but can you give me any precise numbers on how many of the 300 megawatts are from small wind projects?
Mr. Starbuck.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty, we have about 340 megawatts online. 300 megawatts are large projects, 100 megawatt blocks each. The remainder are small projects that go back several years, actually. You know, in large projects, that's all we have. We are negotiating in response to the RFP that we issued last summer with a number of small projects. Those have not. So, you know, the negotiations are going well, but they haven't led yet to projects under contract. The 40 small projects I was referring to are small distribution level interconnected projects that GRE is not the purchaser from. It's the local distribution cooperative.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Schaubacher? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Bly, would you or Mr. Blackburn like to make any closing comments?
We do have a handout here that I'd like to share with members and let Mr. Blackburn speak to it, and then I do have some closing remarks.
Perhaps you could go ahead and address the handout.
My name is Paul Blackman. I'm the Executive Director of the Community-Based Energy Development Initiative. What I prepared for you all is a current status report on community energy development in Minnesota. And these numbers come from a combination of AWEA, the Department of Commerce, and the Wind Industries database, and they're from last year. I also have at the top of the page a comparison of Minnesota's local community energy ownership or wind energy ownership compared to other countries around the world, some select other countries. And I think it's useful to look at the kind of targets that I hope we agree are our goals. In the Netherlands, you can see a 65% local ownership. In Germany, it's 50%. In Denmark, it's 90%. The Danish Cooperative Wind Energy Association claims to have over 150,000 Danes who have invested in local wind ownership projects and local wind projects. How many of you know anybody who's invested in wind energy in Minnesota? And how many people, is that you know altogether? In Minnesota right now, we have about 24% of projects are community-based. And if you look at the bottom, the chart in the middle, this shows on a yearly basis the installation. Now you'll see that the community energy projects there are in blue. And you see that those were peaking a few years ago before the seabed statute was passed. Those are projects that were supported by the REPI in Minnesota. Since the seabed project, since the seabed law is passed, in 2000, the only project that's online right now is a 2.5 megawatt project that was installed in 2007. That was a seabed law project. But at the same time, you see that the corporate wind development has increased steadily over the years. And there are some gaps there, and you can see that those gaps in the red lines where they drop down, it's when the federal production tax credit went away. You can see what a dramatic impact the loss of that tax credit has had on the corporate wind energy development. At the same time, some of those years, Minnesota's community energy folks stepped up to the plate and filled in the gap. And then finally, you can see that the last chart is the percentage share of community wind. Now, I could have monkeyed with this chart to make that graph look much deeper, but I didn't. But I think it's very important to understand. For example, between 2006 and 2007, community wind energy dropped roughly 4%, 5% market share. And that's because the 200 plus megawatt Fenton project, corporate wind project, came online. Now, you need to remember that because these are percentages, in order for community wind to regain that market share, it would need to install in excess of 200 megawatts next year, and corporate wind would have to install nothing. What I mean is that it's very difficult to regain market share once community energy has lost it. And I think there's some people talk to that, today about the market share and how these are going and what contracts they have. But this is installed projects in the ground, and not all contracts that they've entered into are going to become real. So I think it's very important for the committee to realize that we're slipping in community energy. And that slippage is going to be very hard to regain. And so far, the seabed law has not proven to create a lot of projects, and hopefully it will, but it hasn't. I think unless members of the committee have particular questions about this or about other aspects of the feed-in tariff, I think I'll leave it at that. I'm happy to talk with folks individually about the feed-in tariff. I think there's been some pretty gross distortions about how it works here, and some significant misunderstandings about how the cost structures that work and the safeguards that are in fact in place in this law. Thank you.
Questions for Mr. Blackburn? Representative Bly?
First of all, I want to say that the purpose of this bill certainly is not to make the lives of the utilities or the cooperatives more difficult or to cause them pain in any way. But it does represent an effort to try to bring innovation to the way we think about energy, and taking in mind concerns that are out there about the increasing cost of energy, the risk that creates for our nation's security, and also the future of costs for everyday citizens about energy and the reliability of the energy source that they have. Energy is probably the most important factor in human development going forward, and it depends on what kind of energy we have available and what kind of energy we can call to serve us that allows us to move forward. And I think this represents a proven way to look at how we can change our direction in energy production: less reliance on fossil fuels, less reliance on nuclear energy, and reliance on renewable energies that will are sustainable and we can hang on to. So you can't necessarily rely, when you want to do new thinking and have innovation, on the existing structures. You have to think in a different way about them. And this is one of the things that attracted me the most to what's been happening in Germany and Spain and their efforts with the feed-in tariff. And although utilities and cooperatives resisted in those countries this kind of change, they no longer resist because they see that it is working. And if you compare from what I understand from the research that I've read, you compare the ongoing costs of energy and energy development in the countries that have adopted the feed-in tariff and those that have taken the renewable energy standard thing policy as we have done, the costs are cheaper in the long term. Some of the things that we've heard today and the other day about in criticism of the pricing are looking at feed-in tariff in isolation, or when really you need to look at it in the whole system. And if we're going to ask hard questions about the economics of how this works, we need to ask the same questions about the standard itself and how we're going to implement that and the costs associated with it. So maybe to cut my remarks short, I will just repeat what some of the information that I cited from the experience in Germany. And the latest figures show that in Germany that 214 people are now employed in that sector in around 15 years of the development of it. Projects for the U.S., it's even a poor relation to the FIT, were implemented to state that over 350,000 new jobs, this is in the United States, would be created if naturally we adopted such a policy. The figures would undoubtedly be higher if a feed-in tariff were implemented, as many smaller producers could participate in the sector and more technologies would be supported. It would be a way of increasing innovation in all kinds of sectors in our economy. And I think it would be short-sighted not to at least consider this as an option and continue the conversation about it. And I would ask for your support and hope that you'll vote for it and move it out of committee.
Just for the record, Representative Bly, I don't think you meant to say 214 people.
Oh, no, excuse me, 214,000 people. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Farris, did you have a question or a comment?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just don't see the purpose of this bill. And every time you turn around here this year, last year, we're trying to raise the cost of energy. And the cost of energy is getting out of control. And I just don't see the purpose of this type of bill at this particular time. It's ridiculous. I mean, Minnesota has been a leader in in renewable energy. And all the things that we do around here are all about renewable energy in this committee. It's all centered around that. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would make a motion to delete Section 3 and 4 from the bill, and I'd ask for a roll call vote.
Representative Hackbarth, that motion would be in order, but we did not intend to vote on the bill this evening. I don't know if you're aware of that. My intention is to lay the bill over. would you like to address your motion? As to sections 3 and 4,
well,
of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I spelled out exactly why I would like to do that. The cost of the bill, and if you get rid of the tariff issues in the bill, I think that takes care of my concerns.
Well, certainly, I think that that is a portion of the bill that deserves some attention and some further consideration. That's one of the reasons that I decided to hold the bill over so that we could have that discussion. But as I said, your motion is in order. Given that, the clerk will take the roll on the Hackbarth motion to delete from the bill sections 3 and 4. Chair votes no.
Representative Beard? Representative Bly?
No.
Representative Reinhardt?
No.
Representative Gardner?
No.
Representative Gunther? Representative Hackbarth?
Aye.
Representative Hopi? Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Kalin?
Negative.
Representative Knuth?
No.
Representative Magnus? Representative Norris? Representative Osment? Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Rood? Representative Saylor?
No.
Representative Solcom? Representative Wagenis? Representative Welty?
Yes.
Representative Westrum?
There being two ayes and nine nays, the Hackbarth motion does not prevail. Is there further discussion at this time? Representative Bly, we will be laying this bill over. I hope we can have some productive discussions about what we can do with the bill and possibly include it into the omnibus energy bill that we hope to put together.
I look forward to it.
So with that, the bill is laid over and this meeting is adjourned.